As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
What are you doing at 3 p.m. on May the 18th? Because the WSL title race could go down to the final day. It's been a roller coaster week. After losing to Liverpool, Chelsea's Emma Hayes had given up hope.
And of course we will go to the end, but I don't think the title will be heading to us this year.
But this was her just 4 days later.
Let me be clear. It's not f***ing over.
How did that happen? Well, Man City lost in stoppage time, letting in 2 goals in 3 minutes.
As Kim Little picks out Blackstone, yes, you are kidding me! 2-1 Arsenal in stoppage time. City's title party on pause.
And then Chelsea scored 8.
Guro Wrighton's cross is good. It's 8. Chelsea overtake Manchester City in the goal difference column. And even she can't believe it.
As Hayes said, what are the odds? So will Man City slip up cost them the title? Who's the favourite now to win the WSL? I'm Sophie Penny, and from The Athletic, this is Full Time Europe. The WSL may be going down to the wire, but Barcelona were crowned champions of their league at the weekend. More on that later.
They are competing against themselves. I think that's why they are so good, because they are trying to beat themselves, not any team.
With me today is The Athletic's Katie Wyatt and our full-time columnist, Jessie Parker-Humphreys. Hi, both.
Hello.
Hi.
Jessie, I'll come to you first. What a dramatic week. 1 minute you were writing a piece about how Chelsea's quadruple attempt had unravelled in 32 days, and now Chelsea are in with a shout.
I couldn't really quite believe what was happening, because I thought in the City-Arsenal game, Arsenal looked so out of it, and then Justina Blackstenius pops up and it changes it all. And I guess then at King's Meadow, it kind of just felt like a bonkers atmosphere, crowd cheering on every goal, and yeah, totally turned around in 4 days. I don't know who's made me look stupider, Gareth Taylor or Emma Hayes, but I've got to put the blame at one of them after a crazy, crazy Sunday.
So Chelsea are 3 points behind City with a game in hand. Chelsea are now one ahead on goal difference. And as if the whole thing wasn't crazy enough, we have to remember that Arsenal also ended Man City's 14-game winning streak in the league. So that was a result in itself, wasn't it? But Katie, obviously the title is kind of the key part of this. You've been watching the WSL for years, haven't you? And it could come down to the final day this year. This is what we want from the product that is the WSL. Can you remember another title race that came so close? How does this kind of compare? Where does it sit? How important is it for both teams with what's on the line?
Yeah, it's not been as close as this since it turned full-time professional in 2018. It's always been a very honorary, it could go down to the final day, like last season when Chelsea had Reading, but they were always realistically going to win that. So it's always been tied up. Before then, it was only those early days of the WSL when we had potentially going to 3 different destinations, or the destination of the title changing as the day wore on and as the results shifted. So they were the more exciting ones in terms of the last day. But this feels very different because so many more eyes on it with the TV deal. But because the characters and the personalities feel so central to this, maybe that's because it's Emma Hayes' last season, but because the way that she's acted and she's behaved, the eyes on her over the last few weeks, the fact that her big rival Yona Seidevall has given her a lifeline and potentially helped win the title for her, the fact that Manchester United and Manchester City will be looking at each other for a little bit of help on that final day, Manchester United maybe winning the title for City, and it all feels very, very different because those personalities and the rivalries, the needle and the bite is more present than it ever has been before. It's never felt like this in that sense. So that's the way that, to me, it feels very, very different, that the personalities, the rivalries, the characters, the narratives are taking on such a central role in this. So that, for me, is where the real kind of meat of this title race is.
I remember before the start of the season, we were saying, oh, no team has won the WSL having lost more than two. And now this season, we know that we will have a champion that's lost at least three. So that kind of speaks to how competitive the league is. Man City haven't won the title since 2016, have they? They've kind of had five times where they came second. Jesse, I want to go into this Man City-Arsenal game. As you wrote in your column on The Athletic, at the 88th minute, Man City had one hand on this WSL trophy. So I want to ask you about those late goals. Why do you think that City conceded them? Was it to do with their changes they had to make with their back line? Was it Arsenal's attacking subs?
I think definitely the substitutes Arsenal made felt like they really turned the game around. I think in the first half, City, I think, had a bit of nervousness about them, but Arsenal's attack felt so disjointed that when they did get into the final third, lots of their play broke down. And I think, you know, that kind of allowed City to feel quite comfortable, despite the fact that, you know, there were moments where it felt like Arsenal could take advantage if they could string anything together. That really changed, I think, when Kim Little came on for Frida Marnham in that second half. We've known all season that playing City is a lot about how you marshal and deal with Yui Hasegawa. And Arsenal had tried putting Marnham on Hasegawa before in the FA Cup and it hadn't really worked then. I was quite surprised to see Idaval go with it again. And it felt like as soon as Little came on, you saw the confidence Arsenal had in possession really grew. And then I think obviously as the game pushed on, they were able to push City back further and further. And for me, actually, this is really where Bunny Shaw's absence was felt. We thought when she had that foot injury and was ruled out for the rest of the season that maybe the goal scoring element would be the one that affected City. And who knows, you know, how many they might have scored if she had been playing in this game. But she's so crucial in terms of the work she does off the ball, whether it's going into midfield to try and put pressure on opposition players, whether they can play a long ball up to her and have her hold it up. Those things are so important for a team to relieve pressure. And I think that's just what City were unable to do. Even before Stina Blackstenius gets her first, Caitlin Ford has a magnificent chance to equalise then as well. So it's not like Arsenal just scored sort of two goals out of nowhere. And then you kind of, unfortunately for City as well, get an error from, you know, one of their best players this season in Alex Greenwood, who ends up ball watching and misses Blackstenius for the second. And, you know, football's brutal.
Let's talk about that defence then, because Kirsten Kasperi had to come off, didn't she? Because she had, it looked like an injury of some kind. And so Alana Kennedy comes in. Alana Kennedy moves into centre-back alongside Alex Greenwood. It was Steph Horton's last home game. A lot of people were calling for Steph Horton to maybe be brought on, not necessarily just for a sentimental reason, but potentially for footballing reasons as well. I wanted to get your take on that, Jesse. Do you think that those changes to the defence had an impact, and should he maybe have brought Horton on instead?
I personally don't think so. I think Alana Kennedy she's been in and out of the team all season. She's very obviously sort of that next string down of centre-backs if sort of Alexandri is going to pair up with Greenwood. With Kasperi going off, we've seen Alexandri play full-back all season. I think it made perfect sense to reshuffle in that manner. Kennedy is also someone who's like good in the air, and if you're thinking about a team trying to score towards the end, I can see why she'd be the first choice. The only thing that I've kind of thought in hindsight is whether with City sort of under the cosh a bit, Horton coming on, actually trying to harness that emotional reason, trying to use that as a way
galvanize
to boost
them.
The team. Exactly. But I can see how you also think this is a match. Take the motion out of it. Who is the first choice centre-back to come on if you need to replace one? For me, that's Kennedy every time. I don't think there's any real argument for it to be Horton. And actually, in City's bigger games this season, the more defensive changes we've actually seen them make has been having a player like Demi Stokes come on. So Horton really just hasn't been in and around that. And I think it would have involved ripping up a lot to bring her on. And listen, let me play it back the other way. If Horton comes on and the same things happens, aren't we just sitting here saying Gareth Taylor lent in too much to the sentimentality and didn't play the game in front of her?
Definitely. I think that is actually a very good point. But also we have to remember that none of this would actually be relevant in the title race if Chelsea hadn't also scored 8 goals. Let's come to you first, Jesse, kind of around the footballing side of it and how on earth Chelsea turned it around from, you know, conceding 3 set pieces and 4 goals in one half against Liverpool to an 8-goal emphatic win against Bristol City. I mean, what changed?
Well, I don't want to dampen the enjoyment of what was a fantastic game, but I think lots of the issues Chelsea had at Liverpool were present in this Bristol City game as well. And, you know, the way these
Are you complaining about an 8-goal win?
I'm not complaining. I'm just putting my tactics hat on. And look, Chelsea scored 2 in the first half. And towards the end of the first half, Bristol City were getting those same kind of transitional moments that we saw Liverpool really benefit from. And Emma Hayes made a half-time substitution to deal with that. Nuskan came off, Fran Kirby came on. Obviously, against Liverpool, she waited until she made that change. And I thought that was an interesting thing for her to do. And the XG finished 4.7 to Chelsea, but Bristol ended up with 1.5. So I think to a certain extent, Chelsea might have got away with one a little bit. And I feel like the game really changed in the second half when Wrighton, I think, just took it on upon herself to start shooting on sight. And it felt like that was really what motivated Chelsea to start banging in the goals. Obviously, as the game went on, Bristol sort of collapsed more and more. But I didn't think it was like, I mean, I don't know what an 8-0 performance was. I didn't think it was a perfect performance from Chelsea. I think, you know, in the same way we're talking about the emotion with Horton, Chelsea as a team, I think, harnessed the emotion that was at King's Meadow to push them to score goals in a way that maybe their performance didn't entirely belie at points.
And that emotion, obviously, because it was Emma Hayes' final home game at King's Meadow, also Fran Kirby's and Maren Mjelde's. Katie, can we please talk about Emma Hayes? Because that turnaround this week was just ridiculous, from kind of writing off their chances to then saying it's absolutely not over. What did you make of that? I mean, Karen Carney called it weird when Emma Hayes said she'd kind of given up. What did you think of it?
Do you know that meme of Gemma Collins in the Big Brother house when she goes, "I don't want to play any more games, I'm gamed out." And that's how I feel covering Emma Hayes over the past few weeks, because it is a little bit like getting whiplash, just trying to keep up with the story off the field. And maybe this was the point that she was making when she was talking about the pressures on managers and the way that she's used as a mouthpiece and her words taken out of context, and just how much emphasis we put on that off-field side that so often overshadows what actually happens on the pitch. But yeah, after the Liverpool game, she did this interview where she brought Aggie Beaver-Jones on with us and said, "Oh, I've won loads of titles and had loads of opportunities to win titles, but it won't be this year, probably. Yeah, it won't be this year." And really downbeat, emotional interview with Sky. And then we cut to the studio and Karen Carney is very... all she can say is weird, and she's just shell-shocked by this very uncharacteristic interview from Emma Hayes. And Caroline Barker is the one who's saying, "Well, we've seen her read that poem. We've seen her do weird things before. Could there be a bit more to this?" And then after the game at full time, when Emma Hayes was being presented with everything, and they played the video to mark the end of her King's Meadow spell at Chelsea, and she was saying, "It's not over. We all need you at Spurs if we're going to win that title. We've still got a chance of winning this." And then you were like, okay, yeah. So this was, as she admitted in the press conference, a mind game to take the pressure off players. And it's been a very weird few weeks covering her, I think, especially since the shove and the way that there was the non-apology for that, the poem, the way that gathered legs very quickly. All of the press conference has kind of become not a sideshow, but such a massive part of the storyline. And I think at least in the immediate few weeks and months after her leaving Chelsea, all of that off-field stuff is still going to play a fairly significant role in how we talk about her legacy, because it's whether she's tinged the legacy, not just by winning anything, but how bizarre the last few weeks has been in terms of her public utterances. But yeah, in terms of mind games, this is why we're saying that narrative side and the personalities feel so central to this, because never in the WSL, in my experience, have we seen something where off-the-field trash talk and the talk, even when someone said, "Are you going to thank Jordas?" And she was going, "Well, not going to say anything, but I do like Swedish players. I've always like Swedish players and just this needle and this bite there. So it's been a very, very weird thing covering that. Very entertaining. But I also just feel a bit like, this is going to be interesting to step up that roller coaster when it finally finishes.
I'm not having it as mind games. I'm sorry. Because she needed Idaval to do her a favour. And you can't play a mind game if you need two teams to do something totally different to make it go your way. I understand the logic. Oh, you're taking the pressure off the players. But clearly there was so much pressure on the players. And, you know, they'd had an incredibly emotional week. But when you've got Neve Charles, Erin Cuthbert, Aggie Beaver-Jones all crying up at Prenton Park, that to me doesn't feel like mind games. And, you know, I think what was interesting is, one, Emma Hayes is absolutely a master, actually, both at the mind games, but also at manipulating situations to her own advantage. And I think this is what, you know, lots of the chat she had in the press conference went that way. But I did think what was interesting as well, though, were her comments, which she said on the pitch, and she also said to Sky, I believe, about, you know, how she'd also learnt from the team and her players about belief this week. And I do think there was a sense that, you know, and Katie's touched on it, the amount of bizarre stuff we've had, to me, has screamed not just someone who's trying to distract, but also someone who's become quite overwhelmed by the whole situation herself.
Yeah.
And I thought those comments were really interesting in terms of, you know, leaning on her players potentially as well. When that door opened and that opportunity came, they were the ones who pushed their way through. And in the game itself, it was amazing in some ways that Aggie Beaver-Jones probably was one of the standouts. I think Wrighton was Chelsea's best player, but Aggie Beaver-Jones was definitely up there. So, you know, so from going from her hostage situation at Liverpool, where she'd also been Chelsea's best player, to go and like push against Bristol City, I think it was a really important reminder, I guess, maybe to everyone that we're so focused on the Emma Hayes sideshow, which is both because we're talking about her legacy and her leaving and her impact on the league, and also because she's a box office person. But, you know, there's a real club and real players who are also fighting to win. You know, Beaver-Jones is someone who's never won a senior trophy with Chelsea, even though, you know, we know they've won loads. But that's something that's still meaningful to her. And I think as we look towards what Chelsea looks like next season without Hayes and in the future, this whole finish in some ways has felt like it's taken on sort of a powerful legacy in its own way that exists separate to Emma.
You're absolutely right when you say that Emma has probably become very overwhelmed by the end of the season and the life that all of this off the pitch stuff has got, because she said in a press conference, and anyone who's watched Emma's press conferences, you can get them on YouTube, the club put them on there, will know that they have so many elements to them. On Sunday night, we saw very light-hearted moments when she was talking about Lauren James commentating on the Arsenal game. We saw very vulnerable moments when she was talking about just the exhaustion of this season. And then you also see moments of advocacy when she was talking about the role that female coaches had to play, and you see moments where she's maybe a little bit more defensive and more critical. And we saw on Sunday she was talking about deleting social media and the criticism that she's been under this season, and she'd alluded to it in a slightly more lighthearted, joking way on the pitch, talking about the last 2 months and how people had let her know that there was so much that she was not doing right. And I think that she's probably been slightly taken aback by how far her reach is and the ramifications of the shove and the way that she dealt with it and the quotes that she made about player relationships and just how much momentum and how many legs all of that seemed to grow, which is a testament to how much bigger the profile of the game is, how people listen when she speaks, how big her profile is. And to balance all that while she's got one eye on the US job, one eye on Chelsea, it is a lot. And she said that she felt exhausted. She's felt like a piece of meat at times with the way that she's been talked about in the press, the way that her quotes have been parroted and things, the way that she's been picked apart on social media. So there's a lot to it. And I think this is a very interesting title for being won or lost amid all of that.
Definitely. And I think if they don't win the league title, then obviously even more questions are asked about when it was announced that she was leaving for the US women's national team. Did that have an impact? Just briefly to wrap this chat up, who do you think will win it? I'm not sure I can really fairly ask Jessie, so we'll start with Katie, but we will come to you after Jessie.
I change my mind on this every 30 seconds, because on one hand, if Chelsea beat Spurs, then City have got to better Chelsea's final day result by 2 goals. And that, without Bunny Shaw, might be a big ask, but also maybe not, because of Villa's form this season. But then Chelsea have been so hit and miss, and as Jessie explained, lots of holes in that Bristol City performances as well, that a team like Manchester United, even though they're not in the best of form, might exploit. So I genuinely can't call it. In 1 minute I think it's for City, and 1 minute I think it's for Chelsea. if you ask me now, I'll probably change my mind in the next 30 seconds. So I can see strong arguments for both. I think I'm... See, I can see Chelsea slipping up just as much as I can see City failing to beat whatever scoreline Chelsea. I'm going to go for City, I think.
All right, we have to ask Jessie quickly so Katie doesn't change her mind in the meantime.
I think giving Chelsea a second chance was very foolish. That's all I'll say.
We'll leave it at that. So Chelsea play Spurs and Man United and City play Aston Villa. Let's have a quick look towards the bottom of the table where the results there could have a big impact on the future of the league as a whole.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to Full Time Europe from The Athletic.
Sophie Penny, Katie Wyatt and Jessie Park-Humphreys here with you on Full Time Europe. So because Bristol City were relegated, that means that next season, the WSL will be entirely made up of clubs affiliated to Premier League sides. Katie's been writing about this on The Athletic. Katie, we'll come to you first. Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? What do you think?
Again, it's something that I've sort of toyed with a lot, because I think it was something that had to happen for the league to go professional when it did in 2018-19. And I think that there wasn't the infrastructure or the finances or anything in place to support women's teams going professional in the way that the league needed, in the way that the national team needed, without significant support from Premier League clubs. But I think once they did that, and I think once particularly the league did it in 2013 with Manchester City taking the place of Doncaster Bells, the clubs and the FA and the league cast their lot in with men's clubs, for better or worse. And we've seen, obviously, the downsides of that is that boom and bust cycle where clubs have been really well funded for a year, the men's team lose, then or a women's team gets relegated, it's the first thing that's cut. But then we've also seen, as in Chelsea's case, the things that Emma Hayes has built would not have been built as emphatically and as well and as quickly without the support financially of a well-funded men's Premier League team. So there are definitely pros and cons against it. I think the downside to it is obviously that it leaves us financially on very shaky ground, that the game isn't self-sustaining at this point, but also that in a case like Bristol City have built things off the field to a point where they've not won a home game all season, yet they've been attracting crowds of 7,000 has been their average, the highest outside of the top four, and even those top four attendances are inflated by the big stadia Premier League games. And they've managed to have a very low fan base. They've done different things. When we talk about women's matches being like Glastonbury, Bristol City have done all kinds of things to maybe go, well, we're not a Premier League team, but how can women's football look? What's the canvas that we're working with to attract fans, to engage the community? You just had to think outside the box in a way that is really, really impressive. So I think that clearly they can't compete off on the field without a Premier League club, because look at their results, look at their goal difference, look at everything that's happened to them on the field this season. But off the field, they've built something really, really special. And I think it's a shame that the current model doesn't allow them to flourish in terms of points and results, even though they've clearly unlocked something that is really pretty impressive and probably the envy of a lot of bottom half WSL teams in that sense. So it's hard because now the current way that the league is structured, the financial side of it, is that there is only really one way to do it, and that, yes, you can build an engagement, but in terms of on-field success, you need money and you need Premier League money, and you need high-end, top-level, top-four, top-six, big-six Premier League money.
Are we saying that then? Do you think that this is sort of the turning point, and this is the moment where from now on it won't be possible if you don't have a Premier League club? Because obviously with Bristol, you know, they were having to field a very young team. They had the youngest average lineup, 24 years, 136 days. They also had injuries to key players, you know, Abby Harrison, Rachel Furness, their number one goalkeeper, Fran Bentley. You know, there were other factors involved in their demise, I suppose, in the fact that they didn't win. So are we saying that now, from now on, we don't think it will be possible? Or do we think that perhaps we could look at Bristol and think, oh, well, there were reasons why they went down?
Maybe. I think the bigger question is, because the WSL is moving from the control of the FA to Newcastle's control as of next season, and it comes just after Karen Carney's written her review about women's football having to be wise and look at new revenue streams. And I think it's whether the league, whether clubs, whether stakeholders play lip service to those recommendations. And Carney talks a lot about how you're maybe going to have to slow down growth in order to do it sustainably, because it's been so accelerated over the past 5, 6, 7 years, or whether the league actually looks at those and looks at other revenue streams, looks at where money's coming from, looks at having clean money and not sports washed money. And I think it depends on how well the league and how well clubs are willing to innovate and go along with that. But I think at the moment, the path is very much set in favour of clubs backed by big Premier League teams.
And Jesse, we had a listener, Shahan Mayer, who runs the other BCWFC fan page, who was very keen for us to talk about why Bristol City got it wrong. And I think there will be a lot of people who are fans of clubs that aren't backed by Premier League teams who will be worried by this conversation. What do you think about this affiliation with Premier League teams, and also potentially about what Newco could do to change that situation when they come in to run the league from next season?
Yeah, I do think the Premier League affiliation feels inevitable, and I think that's quite depressing. But I think it's also important to say that it's kind of been a bit, not lucky, but like there are a lot of different versions of events that could have happened this season. Obviously, partly the reason it's all Premier League next year is because Leicester City men got promoted. And yeah, also we were very close to a situation where Charlton or Sunderland would have been promoted, and then it wouldn't have been the case next year. And I think what's interesting, I guess, is we often talk about this from kind of a Newco or an organisation, FA perspective, but I find it very interesting why we don't talk about it more from a club perspective, because realistically, we know that the amounts of money that are going into making a WSL team at the moment, it is not huge. And if we are just looking at sort of championship wage bill, Leeds United have a championship wage bill of £39.5 million. And they have a women's team that plays in the fourth tier of football. So I think there's a little bit of an onus on the clubs as well. Okay, I guess, you know, Leeds might become a Premier League team next year if they win the championship playoffs. But there's a little bit of an onus on clubs if, you know, we want a diverse WSL, that it's not like there's no money lower down the levels. In fact, famously, clubs manage to get themselves in lots of trouble financially because they're so obsessed in spending loads on their men's team. I think the financial construction of English football is incredibly, incredibly complex at the moment. And whilst Premier League teams might have the opportunity to more easily and readily spend that money, there's also choices being made by clubs within that. And I guess that's what's interesting about the Bristol City example, because on the one hand, I kind of really like what Bristol City have done. They kept their core of championship players. They didn't try and add too much. They didn't try and, you know, force themselves into spending in a way that might not have been sustainable. But I also would question a little bit whether they couldn't have chosen to do more. They, I think, made a choice that that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to bring those young players through. They wanted to have that connection with the players who got them promoted. And that will probably stand them in good stead next year, rather than potentially going for a load of players, still getting relegated anyway, and then they all leave again. And you have to start from scratch. But I do think, you know, it's more complicated than just saying only Premier League clubs can do well. Because I think, and this, I guess, will be interesting in we've not mentioned yet, but independent ownership and, you know, what Michelle Kang might do with London City Lionesses. There are clearly, I think, opportunities to game the women's football system if you're smart. I think there are lots of clubs in the WSL, maybe not many in the WSL anymore, but also in the Championship, which are not necessarily as well run as they could be. I think if you're going to put the right people in place and put a lot of focus and attention on it, and attention costs money, but it's not the same as just spending. I think they're different things, that I think then that opens up maybe more interesting pathways for teams.
I think that is a really interesting point, Jesse, about kind of how clubs choose to split their funds. It's not like the funds aren't there, but it's in terms of prioritisation as well. And that's another conversation that needs to be had. So I think that is a really interesting kind of nuance to bring to that discussion. And I'm sure people listening will have opinions on this, because we've got fans from lots of different clubs who listen to the show. So please do get in touch with us at fte@theathletic.com or via email, or at Sophie Penny, PENNEY _ on Twitter as well. Right, we're heading to Spain next.
You're listening to Full Time Europe with Sophie Penny.
Let's bring in The Athletic's Barcelona reporter, Laia Cervello Herrero. Hola, Laia.
Hola.
So Barcelona won the Liga FA on Saturday with four games to go. And with that, they become the first team to win five straight Liga FA titles, their ninth title overall. They've had no losses all season, just one draw, and their goal difference, wait for it, 109. The next best is Real Madrid with 37. They only conceded 9 goals, Barcelona. Now, Laia, I know we spoke a couple of weeks ago on a podcast about kind of how the league in Spain needs more investment to be more competitive. They've won the league. How have they created one of the best teams in the world in one of the least competitive leagues in Europe?
Yeah, I think everything began with the current coaching staff arriving at the club. Because they went there with one idea in their minds, that was winning one Champions League. And when they were beaten against Olympique Lyonnais in 2019 in the final, in the first final they arrived, they started to think, okay, we need to make a team that is capable of competing physically with other teams in Europe, because we are super far away. And they started to say, okay, we need to maybe train more, do 2 training sessions per day. We need to get more physically prepared for that kind of games. And the club said, okay, we are going to invest on you. We are going to give you the chance to do that with economical effort and all that. And they did it. They have created a staff that knows really well the players, that even though Luis Cortés is not in the team, Jonathan Giralt was his manager assistant at that time. So it's like kind of a legacy of in the staff that has created one of the most competitive teams in Europe. And probably it's like the roots of the Spain winning the World Cup also. And as they don't have competition in the league, they are super focused on, super obsessed on making the players, each one, the best they can be. And they give them like videos of every game. Like, maybe sources from the club have told me that they give them each player maybe 15, 20, 50 videos after every game to see what have they done wrong and to try to improve everything, even though the rival is easy to beat. So I think that's one of the keys, doing that every player is like the best they can be. And I think they have created a lot of confidence with the players. The players want this stuff to continue because they feel that they are better with them. So I think that's the key, because normally we talk about the players and the club investing on the best ones, but you have to have a staff that really believes in the project. And they did it. They did it when they weren't winning anything for 4 years, not even the league. So it's crazy to think how that has changed, because some of the players are the same ones. Alexia, for example.
You're so right to point that out, because, as you say, the big names have been there, but the project has built something that has made them into these superstars. And what will have massively helped with that will be that continuity, you know, having Fran Sanchez replaced by his assistant Luis Cortés, who's then replaced by his assistant Jonathan Giraldez, as you say. That will have provided a fantastic base for the development of these superstars. I remember you were telling me before as well that in matches now, Barcelona kind of set their own targets, don't they, outside of winning the game, which they see as inevitable?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. For example, I won't lose any ball in this game. I will create that number of chances. I will be able to, if I try to do three dribblings, the three dribblings attempted will be successful. So these are the things that they are competing against themselves. So I think that's why they are so good, because they are trying to beat themselves, not any team. So I think that's interesting.
We spoke before about the big names in the team. This season, they've played almost half a season without Alexia Putellas. Obviously, they've had a Ballon d'Or winner, Aitana Bonmatí, on top form. But outside of those other names, who else should we be giving credit to for this league victory?
I think one of the most interesting things of Barcelona is that they can survive with their best player. If Aitana is not capable to play because she's injured or something like that, they are going to win anyway, because they are not depending on one player. And I think that's why Barcelona is that good, because they have players that can just take other roles. For example, we have seen Patri Jarro in the last 2 years playing as a pivot, which is like her natural position, playing as a more attacking midfielder, playing as a center back. Frida Lonarolfo playing as a left back or left winger. So they have a lot of players that can play in different positions. And I think that's why they are a little bit more unpredictable, even though they have a really one kind of game that you can say, okay, this is Barça playing. But I think the player that has done like a really great season and is normally super underrated is Caroline Graham-Hansen. I think she didn't have the best games between against Chelsea, but I think she has been incredible this season. I think it's her best season, and that was difficult because since she arrived, Barça has won everything. So I think this is quite symptomatic of how good she is and how important it is for the team. So I would say definitely Caroline. Yeah,
I think in this league as well, we have to remember, although the Champions was a kind of a foregone conclusion, there is a battle going on here in the league, which I think Jesse's had their eye on, haven't you?
Yeah, it's obviously, Liga FA is such a fascinating league because I think there are so many exciting teams within it, and it's very easy to get distracted by, you know, that Barcelona win everything, because they do. But it doesn't mean there's not interesting things going on. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how over the next couple of years, and I think this is what something Barcelona want, understandably, those teams do push on and whether they can challenge Barcelona, because the gulf is so big. And obviously the battle for third place at the moment, so that final Champions League spot, is between Atleti and Levante. Atleti just 1 point ahead. And it feels like two teams in really different places. And obviously we've talked about the impact of Premier League teams on the WSL. And we've seen this season in Spain how Levante's financial problems on the men's side have really impacted them on the women's side. Obviously they sold Mayra Ramirez to Chelsea in January. Alba Redondo, who's like their other star player, is going to go, by the sounds of things, to Real Madrid in the summer. And it's kind of sad because they feel like a really exciting team which is maybe being taken apart. But then at the same time, Atleti, a team that rivaled Barcelona a couple of years ago, who were like the last team to win the league before Barcelona went on this run, they've spent a number of years out of those Champions League spots. But it feels like maybe they're starting to pick up momentum again. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see if they are a team who can push on, because for me, the big disappointment in Spain continues to be Real Madrid. And like their just like lack of real interest, I think, in actually being able to push Barcelona.
Mm-hmm. They've only been playing as Real Madrid for about 4 years, haven't they?
Yeah, they bought a team that was called Tacón. So yeah, I agree with everything you said. But I think Real Madrid, I mean, you have to have the board believing in the team. And Florentino Pérez created a women's team because he felt so pressure of doing it, because it was like the only one big team in Europe that didn't have one women's team. But he honestly seems not to care about them at all. So when you have a president that is not believing in you, it's like maybe if they were closer to Barcelona, if he felt that he could win the Champions League, something that is like his obsession, maybe he would invest a little bit more, because he doesn't care about women's football, but he cares about winning Barcelona. So I think this is something that would change a little bit, but I think the gap is still too big between the two teams, because they are in the point where Barca was maybe 10 years ago, and they have 10 years of difference. So I think they have the money and they could do that. And they could just say, have said, okay, we are going to sign the best players in the world, and Emma Hayes, you're not going to go to the USA. You are going to be here. We are going to pay you a lot of money. But they are not doing it because they don't care at all. Or at least that's what it seems to happen, because they are not doing anything to make their players known for the rest of the country. And Barca is so good at doing it. They are doing interviews. They are creating like a big marketing around the players. They are making the players the image of the club. If you think of Real Madrid, you're not going to think of Ateneo del Castillo. You're going to think in Vinicius, in now probably Mbappé. And this is something very important, because the players, I think they feel that they are part of the image of Barcelona. Alexia is now, you go on the street and you see kids with the Alexia shirt, or Aitanas, or Patri Jarros, because like the fans love the players. And this is something that Madrid hasn't known how to do it.
I think it's fascinating, the teams that are trying to kind of catch up with Barcelona and how they're trying to do it, or whether they're actually putting the money in, because it seems like, yeah, as you both said, the teams that are chasing Barcelona are sort of holding some of the money back, and it would be nice to see some more investment in there so they get a bit challenged more. But congratulations to Barcelona for winning the league. And we should also congratulate Bayern Munich, who won the Frauen Bundesliga at the weekend with two matches to go. That's their second league title in a row and their fifth in total. They've had no losses all season and 7 goals against only. So an impressive defensive performance. They play Wolfsburg in the cup on Thursday. They're trying for the double. And in very exciting news, we can reveal that we've got an interview with Bayern Munich and England's Georgia Stanway coming out soon. So look out for that. That's all for today. Thank you so much, Laia, Jesse and Katie.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can read more about everything we've been speaking about on The Athletic. It's $1.99 a month for 12 months. Go to theathletic.com/WSL. And do send in your questions to fte@theathletic.com via email or at @SophiePenny_ on socials. We'd also love it if you rate, review and hit follow wherever you get your podcasts. Bye for now.
You've been listening to Full Time Europe, part of The Athletic Football Podcast Network. The producer was Sophie Penny and the executive producer was Abby Patterson. To discover and listen to other great Athletic podcasts just like this one, including our brand new daily football briefing, search for The Athletic on Apple, Spotify and everywhere else you get your audio on demand.
The Athletic.